Sunshine One Right, and beginning to visit with Leslie this Sunday at supper, the 26th of December, 71. This is the incomplete tape. This is channel one right, channel one over, but no channel two right. Channel one right. Beginning to visit with Leslie this Sunday at supper, the 26th of December, 71. Channel 1 right, and the beginning of the visit with Leslie this Sunday at supper, the 26th of December, 71. Channel 1 right, and beginning of the visit with Leslie this Sunday at supper, the 26th of December, 71. Channel 1 right, and beginning of the visit with Leslie this Sunday at supper, the 26th of December, 71.
It doesn't mean that at all. You don't have to boil it off. I spent 5 hours boiling labels off about 30 wine bottles and took them down there, and all they do is divide it up by color, and they have these, they really do look like convicts with these sticks, you know, and they pound them to dust in big barrels. It's a wonderful way for them to take out their frustrations, these defenseless bottles in these barrels. They're like broomsticks, and they go, ah! You can hear the breaking of glass for miles on all sides.
Well,
where is that, Blessing?
That's in Berkeley at the bottle recycling plant.
Oh, they have some.
Oh, yeah. But they don't recycle the bottles. They don't send them back to the company for reuse. They destroy them completely by pounding them to dust. And then they take that dust and, well, it's melted down. They do something with it, you know.
Yeah.
Make more glass out of it, I guess. But, pretty funny.
Well, you hope they make more glass out of it.
You hope they do, yeah. At least they've got it into the smallest possible particle.
In World War II, FDR put out that plea to all the women's clubs,
mm-hmm,
to collect old newspapers and things.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody calling you. And they had no use for them, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was just to enable the women's clubs to feel patriotic.
Oh, I see. Goodness. That sounds like the New Deal. Goodness.
Well,
I thought they used newspaper, because you can also take your newspaper to this recycling place. You have to bale it up. And I do it, because they tend to put newspaper down in the laundry room, which is the only place I have to keep my bicycle. I don't have a garage. So even though I don't get the paper, I take down the newspaper once a week to keep that space clear. And you have to bail it up. But they do send it off somewhere. I don't know what they do with it. They don't make other newspaper with it. They were telling me what they did with it. It's some odd thing.
Yeah.
But they do reuse it. They make something like guitar paper or something. Maybe they put it in that or something like that. I don't know what they use it for, but they do send it somewhere.
Yeah. That, they wouldn't do that now just to make people feel useful and patriotic.
Mm-hmm. But in those days, I guess it was... Nobody really.
Oh, there's too much of it now. It's just out of all
proportion. Even with changing my address as often as I do, I get in a week, I must get a pound of unwanted paper. Just junk mail, you know, come to Macy's sale or the Telegraph Avenue shopping news, you know, that thick. It's 5-6 pages and all kinds of bargains in it. And the thing is, they don't just drop one off at the apartment building for us all to look at.
Yeah.
They put 10 there, you know, and there's only about 8 apartments. And most of the time, they just sit there in a pile, and hardly anybody even picks them up and looks at them until next week, the next Telegraph Avenue Shoppers News comes and is added to the pile. And those things don't come through the post. They're delivered by runner. But then you get all kinds of things that come through the mail, too. Notices of sales and stuff like that.
And as long as you've got a box, the box holder is going to get something in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been trying to get off the mailing list of this preacher, Babson Barrett, somebody, Batsel Barrett, somebody. And he, they use film clips and everything. He doesn't say much. It's just the editing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the great mistake of writing in one time for something. And I've been on it 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gets tedious. You see, I'm not interested in the slightest. I wouldn't want to encourage it if I could help it.
Mm-hmm. But now you just keep getting it.
It does just what I wouldn't want to do. You see, the animated people and all like that, you see, get such a big job in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I guess, you know, once you have animation, it's just like bulldozers. You've got to use them.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that shameful? Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the trouble. You know, they had the aircraft industry or the air...
Space industry. Right. They have to do something with it now.
They have to use it.
Even though nobody wants to go there anymore.
And it was a catastrophe, you see, just to cut out on it, wasn't it?
Yes, it has been for California.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why the university's in trouble. Well, California, you know, it was heavily into the space industry.
Yeah, and they thought
all
they were made in
Southern California.
Oh, that's right.
At the time of its peak, California was something like fifth in the world in gross national product. The one state was, you know, ahead of France.
Didn't I take that out?
I thought you did. Was ahead of France.
In the amount of growth, what we call gross national product, GNP. The industry.
California wise.
Yeah, it was
California.
US, Soviet Union, and then I think Britain, Japan, and Germany.
And California.
There, and then California.
Right.
Yeah.
So you can see how big and how rich it was. And that's, you see, a lot of that went into the university because you had a public that was deeply committed to higher education. You had parents who didn't want to send their kids back to Harvard where they went, and you had people who didn't go to college but were very eager to have their children go. I mean, you had a public, an electorate, that was strongly committed to the notion of really excellent higher education, and they were bringing in people from Europe, and, well, you know, they built up the greatest public university in the world this way, and money just flowed literally without questions being asked. And there was a lot of abuse, I think, of the funds at times. Then all of that burst. At the same time you have the electorate turning away because of the riots, you also have the money running out.
Oh.
You see, the bubble really burst on them from two sides.
Yeah.
The intellectuals were scapegoated. Somebody had to be responsible for those kids that went wild. We brought those kids up right. And if they went and rioted, somebody had to be responsible. It wasn't us. And so everyone had to find someone to point the finger at, and it was the university, as you might have expected. And certainly in some cases there might have been reasons for doing that. But and then at the same time you have now widespread unemployment in California, over 6%. And so this means that the state is paying out money, not getting it in, you see. Losing tax revenues, and it's paying out a lot of unemployment insurance and things like that. So,
yeah,
more welfare and things like that. So it's hitting the state very hard, and they're not able to balance the budget, and that's why the university has had to, one of the reasons why it's had such terrible cuts. But whenever they have any money to give to the university, they always want to spend it on building new buildings, which we do not need, you know, erecting other parking structures and dormitories and things like that. You know, it's just they won't put it on scholarships or salaries or anything like that, or books for the library. Oh no, capital expansion is all.
I guess that's just universal, isn't it?
It's horrendous. It really is.
Yes.
And you read in the paper about the regents who run the university, their financial committee turned down a mass request of students to increase the scholarship aid. You know, 4 years ago, there was no tuition at the University of California. It was just free, except for your books and your room and board. And now they have it up to, even for residents, I think it's $250 a quarter, which pushes it almost to $1,000 a year. Just fees. So all of a sudden, it's not free anymore.
Uh-huh.
And they claim they don't need money for student aid. And it was really terrible what they did. They recommended that all of the funds they had be put into capital expansion, building new buildings. This was the committee, but then the regents as a whole vetoed that and did give the money to the student aid fund. But it was an easily $1 million at one point.
They
got to
keep.
I mean, they hate students. That's all there is to it.
That's
the only thing that you can conclude from something like that.
That's right.
Whatever you might think about the trustees of Cornell or Harvard or Oberlin, I mean, you didn't really feel that they were evil the way these people, who are political appointments essentially, are. And they're arch conservatives, many of them. People like Mrs. William Randolph Hearst and so forth. It's a political appointment. You know, when they meet in San Francisco, all the TV cameras are on and they have signs in front of them like at the United Nations. Can you imagine if the Harvard Board of Overseers met like that? I mean, it's just an absurdity. It really is. But the regents, you know, it's a political plum to be appointed to one of those regencies. A number of them have made a great deal of money out of it by being ready to build when those buildings were about ready to go up, if you know what I mean.
Just being ready.
They did have a big investigation of the Irvine campus because it was in sort of an isolated place, and as around any campus, sort of a college town began to spring up, you know, laundries and apartments and restaurants and the usual sort of things. And it became clear that one or two of the regents had developed the entire area and had enormous plans for a large-scale redevelopment, such as you have out here now. Out near the Archer Road and all that out there. Don't think somebody has made a lot of money on that. I'll bet they weren't from Gainesville either. What do you suppose?
I imagine not.
Probably whoever sold that land, somebody like C.S. and Pound or that type of person, didn't really get the millions out of it that he could have. You know, he got hundreds of thousands, and then somebody came in from outside building all those apartments. Well, that type of thing was discovered. Reaping the benefits of it. Now they have a code. They passed themselves an amendment to the bylaws of the regents saying that they could only have 1/3 interest or something, whatever. You know, regulating themselves.
Now, this wasn't apparent last year so much.
No, last year things were just sort of beginning to get started. You know, travel funds were cut off if you weren't getting a paper about the middle of November. Fortunately, I had already gotten my travel funds at that time for Christmas. Things began to be, you know, snipped about that time.
Mm-hmm.
The governor vetoed the first faculty pay raise in May, I think it was. He gave a bristling speech, just a scorching speech against the university and particularly against the faculty, just before he vetoed that bill to the prestigious Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, which is, you know, the club on the West Coast for the wealthy. And everybody knew after that, you know, that he would veto the thing. They say he's going to be kinder on the university next year, that he's not going to veto the fund. It remains to be proved. I think he probably will. But they're not even asking for much of a pay raise for next year. I think they've given up. They're asking for 13%, I think. Whereas had we had our normal 5% inflationary increases over the past 3 years, we should, strictly speaking, have 20%. But I think most of the faculty will be happy with 13%. Don't be happy to get anything. for the library this fall was slated to be closed all weekends. And then they found somewhere $50,000. Oh, I know it was. Salary savings. So many people resigned or died or something that they didn't replace. They managed to eke out a little $50,000. I mean, that's just 5 assistant professor positions. It's not even that much. Well, anyway, the chancellor put out the $50,000 to keep the library open on the weekends. I mean, think of that. The library being closed at 5 on Friday and opening up again at 8:30 on Monday. That means students can't go in it. It is closed. I can go in it, but not into the stack.
I hadn't heard that.
Terrible.
I had not heard of anything like that.
Never heard anything.
Never have I. Well, now they were able to prevent that, and it is open on the weekends, Sunday from 1 to 10, and Saturdays from 9 to 5. But it still closes at 6 on Friday, I think. Think of that. Close on Friday night and Saturday night. Sunday morning. You know, at Cornell, the library was open 9 to midnight every day of the year except for the 4th of July, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and one other day. And Sundays it opened at 1.
They won't come in and visit us for a while.
Just a little while.
Well, Nick said they could visit as long as we could stand them.
Well, we don't need that visit now. We've got less than.
No.
Why don't you go out and visit with them? Let me talk to Leslie.
Okay.
Yeah, they're going out somewhere else now.
Okay.
And generally, he's too big a hurry to visit. Leslie, let me tell you, seeing them made me think of it.
Mm-hmm.
I got a letter from one of the alumni at Vanderbilt, and they wanted us to write to the Board of Regents about student morality, the living room, bedroom privileges.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Now they're coming again. They've gone out there as well. And
they'll be in.
He sent a good bit of material. I hadn't gone into those things. I always figure some things there's enough people to go into.
You don't have to do that.
Right.
At least. Right. There must be something that you remember.
The economic stuff here, I don't have to bother my head about that at all. Except listen to Irvin R. Levine. I love to hear him. Do you? Are you allergic to him?
No, I don't think I've ever heard him.
You don't listen to television, do you?
No, I don't.
Well, let me tell you. I got to thinking about it, and I think it's a typewriter. I don't think. I just type out things and then throw it away. And it came to me that, you know, I made some outlandish statement to start with that the Chancellor and the Vice Chancellor and the Board of Regents and all of us stand, made us look all like sitting ducks, you see.
Mm-hmm.
We stand by and watch all this go on. Well, it's just a pop gun. And then at the end, I could tell that it's really, really what they're doing. They're picking you see, the bedroom privileges doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
It's their liberty to not to come to class and not to bring their books.
Right. This is where the university has to assert itself, surely.
See,
not in the private life.
Yeah. The private life, see, doesn't worry me. That is, I don't feel it directly, but the other, you see, I can't cope with it.
Mm.
So I got to thinking at the end of the letter, you know, I wish he could, I'd like for him to cross swords with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish it could be on some other issue.
Right, right. Particularly now, because the trend is so strongly against the university being in loco parentis, you know,
yes,
with policing the private life.
Yes.
Right.
Well, let me tell you.
Didn't used to be that way when I was a student.
Oh, no. Well, the whole thing worked out for me. Nick came by while Miss Davis was over here one morning. And the whole thing came to me. You see, he was going down for Thanksgiving, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and he had this same little girl. And going down to his parents' place, you see, down to Keith. And there the whole thing. They could go, there's no surveillance at all. Was it the only way down? And whether or not they studied the lessons before or after?
Mm-hmm.
And attendance? Or what they wear?
Mm.
There they were, sitting right here at the table. I didn't need any abstractions to handle. There was a case.
Mm-hmm.
So there really wasn't any strings you could pull. And I got to thinking, well, Vanderbilt, you see, when I was there, was mostly for undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
It was developing the graduates, but of course I wasn't a graduate, so I didn't go as an undergraduate. But it wasn't big.
Mm-hmm.
But now you see, the medical school is in competition with Harvard and the engineering with MIT. You see how the direction, everything has to go up the top.
Mm-hmm.
I got to thinking how nice it'd be at Vanderbilt, you see, and the alumni news is wretched. Oh, I hate to read it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like reading a daily newspaper. There's absolutely nothing in it I'm interested
mm-hmm.
in.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to thinking, wouldn't it be nice if Vanderbilt could soft pedal some of the big time things and see what they could do with the undergraduates again.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. But you see, that's as far as I went now, and as far as I can see, they just thrown the undergrads to the dogs.
They really have thrown them to the TAs. That was the thing about going to Oberlin, you know, they don't have a graduate school, and
yeah.
they don't have teaching assistants. I never saw a teaching assistant until I was a graduate student.
Yeah.
And whatever fault some of my teachers had, at least they were members of the faculty, and you never had this feeling that you weren't going to get to anything until maybe your junior year or something like that, which is the way it is at most large universities. They're just thrown in enormous classes, and, you know, maybe they see the professor in a room with 300 people, and then once a week they have what they call a discussion session, and that will be led by a TA, who may be competent, but he may be awfully frightened, or awfully inexperienced, or awful incompetent, or what. I mean, they just pass those TA-ships out to whatever graduate students they have. They don't necessarily undergo any scrutiny the way even the lowliest faculty member has to be checked over before they give him his identity card and turn him loose on the students. But the TAs are really pretty much raw meat, and I know some of ours are incompetent. And probably we usually catch it and don't award a TA ship, you know, to the same man for 2 years if he's incompetent. But it's just not the same as having an actual trained instructor, except perhaps in a few cases where the graduate student is very precocious or advanced or brilliant. And it's just
So what happens to students? Really not much concern.
Not too much. It's not so bad in the classics department, of course, because we don't have very many students, and most of our classes are small.
I mean, the bedroom privileges, and whether they go to class or not.
Well, the bedroom privileges now, almost all of the major institutions that I know of, with the exception of some in the Midwest and in the South, that's thrown wide open. At the University of California, Santa Cruz, for example, it's perfectly possible for boys and girls to room right in the same room. They have what they call co-ed dorms, which just means men in one room and girls in the other, and then they just trade off if they want to, you know, have the same room. It's just set up in that way. Nobody asks any questions, and there hasn't been any trouble about it. The university has, I think, wisely decided that this is something which it cannot effectively police anymore. Just like you say, you know, they can go away for the weekend. you can't.
There's
really,
no use to fight it.
There's no use to fight it. And on the whole, I think it's worked very well. When I was a student, there were cases of pregnancies and other difficulties that cropped up under the Rooney Morco Parentis position that Oberlin was following. You couldn't even have a girl in your room as a guest, except one day a week, and then the door had to be wide open. So, you know, it was pretty strict. You don't read about that sort of thing much anymore. I don't know whether they just keep it quiet or whether it has actually decreased. I think, in fact, that it has. The new birth control devices have made it much more possible to have...
It all floats on that.
It all floats on that. And in California, at least, even though you have to have a prescription to get those pills, you can obtain them as a student from the health service. So any girl who wants to obtain the pills can. I think she has to have a physician.
Yes, that's what's called Planned Parenthood. Faye's sister talks about that.
Yeah.
They, just as soon as they hear an announcement in the newspaper, they send somebody out there just in case that little girl don't know about those pills before she slips up. Isn't that something? Up in East Tennessee. Isn't that something?
Well, the sad thing about that is that in some cases it encourages things which are not good. And others, one has to bear in mind that the pill is absolutely, it's not entirely tested yet.
Yes. Leslie, I wish you could stay down here, or a few hours sometime, and let me tell you what I've done, and you check me on it. Let me tell you, I have gone into, in my sense of the word, see, you are European eyes and have no feeling at all for the Americans, for American life as I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And through Faulkner and Twain and Ms. Rawlins and people like that, see, that's where I have my roots.
Mm-hmm.
And the university is Europeanized.
Oh, very much.
To a great extent. And in my experience, the intellectual traps are enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me tell you, I don't mean to.
No, well, you can see it. There's always a strong British wing in any big university, and there's a strong Central European wing, which is usually Germans and Jewish people from Central Europe who came over because of Hitler and so forth.
Let me tell you, I didn't mean to get too much in that. What I look at, you see, Twain writes these experiences like in Roughing It.
Mm-hmm.
And Ms. Rawlins in Cross Creek, the
mm-hmm.
experiences she has over there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these chaps have no experience.
Mm-hmm.
Education to them consists of abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
And they live with abstractions, as Eric Fromm said, you see. They're not scholarly enough to take the abstractions back into experience.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find is they live with abstractions so much that they aren't really feel comfortable with experience.
That's true.
And they think of experience as something you do scuba diving or something like that,
mm-hmm.
not with the familiar as training as all of that. Well, anyhow. Now what? And they don't write about people. They may write about civil rights, but they don't write about the individual Negro. They don't know a thing about them. Well. We've talked to Miss Daisy down here every week for an hour on here and taped it and studied it for a year or so. And it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal what I didn't know about any of their mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's such faculties as she has.
Mm-hmm.
I never guessed it. Never dreamed of it. Well, you can't. You see, when you're talking to somebody, I've worked in the tape so much, I see that, and I work with this so much, this is almost my business now.
Mm-hmm.
In just ordinary conversation, you actually don't know what goes on. You don't know what you've said.
Mm-hmm.
I see that on the tapes, if I tape something, and then play the tape afterward, I see I didn't know what was going on. Eric Severide said that. One time on the thing that, well, what I heard, and they can't write about people, they just write about abstractions, civil rights. And what I thought I could do somehow or other would find some of these youngsters and sort of, you got to have a sort of long background. I get it in Emerson, you see. to open it up where they can even see Ms. Rawlins without a long background.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I'll develop them. I'll teach them through Ms. Rawlins, and then they can go to the suburbs, you see, or the civic center, the big places, and see people. Well, let me tell you, they can't. For one thing, when they go to the big places, they can't get where they can see.
Mm-hmm.
There's no place to look.
Mm-hmm.
There's no place to listen. And another thing is themselves. Now, Suzanne, you see, has worked with me since the fall of 68. And she knows my system better than anyone else. You see, she's married. And her day, she is free to work on something. When Jim goes to work at 8 o'clock and is out at 5, and she can get off after he leaves, but she's got to get back before he gets back.
Mm-hmm.
That's her day. And at night, he wants to have a little life in common.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, she doesn't actually have much shot at anything.
Mm-hmm.
She can't take hold of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you never had that, you see. You never had that limitation.
No.
You could take hold for 6 days in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And never turn loose.
Yeah.
But she can't. And I find the same thing with the others now. They all got those compulsions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where they can't take hold. Now another little boy, Rick, down here at Miami, is a right gifted fellow. And he came up here and spent a week and worked with him. And he had to pay off $1,000 that he owed his daddy. That his daddy doesn't need.
His daddy could have deducted it as a bad debt. And did better than getting it back.
He's way up in the Winn-Dixie hierarchy, you see.
Mm-hmm.
He can't take off. He can't take off a month or two.
No. No,
now, you don't run into that.
Not yet. I may not be able to choose the month, but I can sort of...
Well, I'm not talking about you, but I mean the people you work with, the young people.
They're much less prone to that. A lot of them are dropping out, you know, because they just won't let themselves get into that kind of situation. Many of them, for example, if they're in love with somebody, they won't actually marry. There's something about the finality of legally tying this relationship that they don't want. And then they live together for 10, 15 years, I think, some of them. Even have children, but they're not actually married. Now, this seems quite common in California. They're just, there are a lot of people that maybe take one course or something like that for a term.
Well, let me tell
stop,
you. Let me tell you
come
now.
Back, so.
You take Cookie. You haven't seen much of him. You know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's a phenomenal fella.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has great gifts. All the skills of the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
Even a short order cook. And he knows horses, and he farms, and he knows all these machines, and
mm-hmm.
knows them personally. Well, you know all they can do? They can talk to him about 30 minutes, and they can't go any further.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't they just take over and do nothing else?
It's awfully hard to talk to somebody when your experiences are so different.
He's very easy to talk to him. And you can work with him.
Mm-hmm.
Very easy to work with him. But they, as far as I can see, they can't project in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can't do anything sustained.
Mm-hmm. That was a remarkable thing about Mrs. Rawlins, wasn't it? That she had such a sensitive nature to all those people that she was in contact with, even though her own background must have been rather different.
Well, it was common in those days. Hemingway never wrote about educated people, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's all you know.
That's not quite true. No, the bulk of the people that I know, of course.
You don't know the others, except in passing?
No, some of the relatives that I have are not, too.
You don't know.
Maybe so.
So you see, you can't read Hemingway. But that's not the point, Leslie. What I'm talking about is they can't give themselves up to anything. They can't take hold, is my word for it.
And they won't commit themselves.
Leslie haven't had that experience with them. You see, they come to class, and that's all he knows about them.
Yeah.
They don't come along.
He was complaining about the times, yeah. That's right.
But you take in scholarship, you see. They don't take hold to learn the subject long very well.
No, they don't. You know, they skip from subject to subject a lot more than we ever did, so I don't know why that is.
One term is over and they go into another.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's institutionalized. Well, that's enough of that.
Maybe that's not so bad, though. Sometimes I think we get over-professionalized too soon. Did they go already?
Yeah, I think they would have lingered if I had encouraged them to. They changed their clothes. Nick said he didn't feel right in his town clothes out here. So he sort of hid out, changed them. They were going to take some oranges to some people in town. Leslie tells me that rent and living in Berkeley is something.
That's
the rent side.
They were trying to get away from that.
Is that right? Oh, you've had.
You had a dose of that. Now
yeah.
You're getting it back.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know what you've been talking about.
You don't want Leslie to come down here and give you the economics.
No, I don't. No, sir.
You see, I take them in the wrong direction. You see, everything I say is he's not interested in. See, I think it was translations. Most of the European books translated are by people who don't know the English language. You get an awful sort of English,
mm-hmm.
not English.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sort of translated English.
There's a translation of Lesky's History of Greek Literature into English. That is the worst I've ever seen. It was a real quick job, I think. And they just, you know, the words like contrary wise. I mean, you know, Gegenüber must have been the original.
See, he don't have to take the living people. He can take the last generation. He ought to come out here and spend the summer and work on some of that, say. Oh, that does need to be done.
Yeah.
Well, all of us would agree that it needs to be done, but nobody wants to do it. It's just translating literature. I mean, you know, real good stuff is something you have to have a real flair for, and not too many are good, I think. And somehow I feel that I'm not terribly gifted at that, so that's why I don't want to do that on translating Homer or Sappho or Aristophanes or what have you.
Well, I'm thinking about it much more elementary thing than that. Just look at the translators' use of the English language.
Yeah, like contrawise.
You'll find something that should never exist.
Oh yes, all the time. Well, even the way Latin and Greek are taught, a lot of the forms of conditions and things like that, we teach them, you know, well, now this is a should-would condition. Well, how often do you? If I should lose my wallet, I would not be able to find it. I mean, that's not what we say, you know. We say, if I was to lose my wallet, I wouldn't be able to find it. And it's awfully hard to teach the little distinctions between the different kinds of conditions in Greek, which are very complicated, and the distinctions are very fine. In fact, they don't exist in English, really.
Yeah.
And all they learn to do in an average beginning Greek course is they just learn sort of a system. What they're learning is non-existent English, or English maybe of Dryden's time or something, to translate these various conditions, and whenever they see them, they say, aha, that's a should would, or that's a shall will, or something. And then they don't really know what the idea behind it is. Namely, you know, there's some possibility that you might lose your wallet. I mean, it's not an impossibility.
Whereas
if you said,
I've got
a word
to
lose my wallet. Yeah.
But Leslie talks pretty much like I do. And
yeah.
Yeah, I'm influenced by Dale Carnegie. I don't have connections. I don't know high of us and all those.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't
either. Leslie doesn't either.
He didn't.
Mm-hmm.
In that little passage there. And I put it all in present tense.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I do it self-consciously, but I don't have to do it self-consciously anymore. it's just...
Well, I still know the other tenses.
Oh, do you really?
Well, see, I've studied it. I mean, I worked it out. Everything comes hard to me, you see. I don't do anything naturally. Until now, it's right painful to listen to some of my colleagues. Especially in the staff meeting, you get some of the weirdest uses of language, you know, and they would do their faces in such extraordinary ways. Isn't that awful?
I was after our departmental meetings, and I'm the recorder this year, which is really bad because you can't miss one. You have to record what they say. They always stick one of the assistant professors with that, you see. You can't say no, you have to be willing to serve. So this year I'm the recorder. And after those meetings, I usually get together with one of my friends, and we go out and really drink it up. It's just the most depressing experience. To go to one of those meetings, and after them I try to analyze, you know, what is it that makes it so depressing? At Cornell I thought it was just, you know, I didn't see eye to eye with so many of them, but here I realize that's not it, because I agree with a lot of them, actually. Our educational philosophies are much more in accord at Berkeley than they were at Cornell. There's less real disagreement in the department, and more of the department of people that I see eye to eye with on a lot of things.
Than at Cornell?
Then at Cornell.
What happened at Cornell?
Well, at Cornell they had a very small department, and I don't know, over half of them were either English or Canadian, and they just had, you know, different ideas about things. And the best man in the department, James Hutton, was, you know, a real gentleman and scholar, an old Scotsman. He's about 68 or so. He'd been kept on after retirement. But, you know, he was a gentleman of the old school, the sort of person I had very little contact with. And while I could see the enormous common sense, in addition to all his learning, the enormous common sense that was always present, I mean, we just didn't see eye to eye on a single thing when it came down to what we should do with students and courses. All my ideas were completely different from his, and that was a little discouraging, because he was the person that I could see at a moment was the brightest and best and most interesting, both to students and anybody else. But in a sense, I think he had just a little bit outlived his time. I don't know, but I just didn't see eye to eye with him on a single thing, and I found that sort of discouraging, and it extended to other members of the department too. But at Berkeley, a lot of them are not too much older than me, and even the two English members of the department are people with whom I can get along very well.
Yeah.
And they don't seem unrealistic and, you know, blind the way so many of them do to the difference between American and English education, which is that our students come to us knowing nothing, and their students come to them trained almost like little machines to ancient languages so that they know them cold by the time they're 15 years old. And any English student who had been through the old system and been to a good private school by the time he went to Oxford knew Latin and Greek code, and probably better than I know it now. As far as the purely mechanical aspects of knowing it are concerned, he knew the vocabulary items, he knew the grammar, he had read an immense amount. But our students don't have that kind of knowledge, and chances are they start Greek when they're about 20, and they'll never know it that well. So, you know, our aims have to be somewhat different. But I haven't really analyzed why it is that I just feel so depressed after those meetings. But I think it's sort of that everyone feels that he has to say what he thinks, first of all.
What?
Everybody feels that he has to say what he thinks, that somehow the mere seeking of the truth becomes crucial at these meetings, and you feel something so strongly that you know this is right, and you have to say it, even when it won't contribute one iota to the advancement of the argument or whatever is going on. I mean, there are times when seeing all sides of the question can lead you absolutely to nowhere. if you know what I mean. I mean, there are times when
Lefty,
you have to sort of pick one facet and try to work it out.
Did you ever know any of your daddy's friends?
Some of them I did, but not
Joe Wise?
No, I don't know him very well. I don't know how well Daddy knew him either. Well, I used to go fishing quite a bit.
Well, that's fishing.
But Mr. Ogilvy, I think, was much more congenial to Daddy than Mr. Wise was.
You knew him through your daddy?
I knew him only through him, yes. And I didn't know him too well, but we used to... He would come over occasionally and we'd talk to him.
But you know, most people you know through other people.
Yes, you do.
And it's hard to realize.
Yes, you do. My family situation was that my daddy was very extroverted, you know, I mean, he was extremely...
Oh, was he?
I didn't realize that, Leslie.
Well, you probably didn't know
him didn't
until
know
he
him,
was getting on in years, but he was the sort of person who actually could thrive in any kind of a social environment. He was sort of like that play, Pygmalion, remember,
yeah.
Eliza's father?
Yeah.
I mean, he just was that type, sort of the lion type, and he could get along anywhere.
Oh, was he?
And I thought always had a large number of friends with whom he would do things like go to football games, go fishing and hunting and all of that sort of thing. The other half of the family, namely mother, was very introverted because of her deafness problem, which she had for many years, and other... She is very introverted and shy, there's no doubt about that. So this meant that she would never... she never really entertained successfully or anything like that. So most of my father's friends were essentially his own, and they were people that we did not know very much, you know, until we got older and would go fishing or something like that with him, and we might get to know them better.
So you don't have much of a toehold in the community?
No, very, very little.
Mostly school people?
Mostly school people. They have dwindled immensely. Linton had his caroling party this year.
Oh, he did.
I can remember the first time I went. I was in eighth grade, and I thought, well, I've made it. I've been invited to the Linton Herbert caroling party. At that time, Linton Herbert and I were bitter enemies.
Oh, really?
We were in the same scout troop or something, so he had to invite me. But in any event, we weren't really bitter enemies, but we quarreled a lot at that stage. We later became much closer. But I remember being invited, and there were so many people there, and this continued for years after I graduated from high school. He always used to have it every Christmas while we were at school, and even one year of graduate school. But the group gradually dwindled, you know, over the years, and many people I have no idea where they are now, and I haven't heard from them for years and years.
Mr. Ogilvy.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't seen much of Linton.
Not too much.
Well, he's taken time off for the last year.
Oh, yeah, I've seen him several times the past year, as a matter of fact.
But you didn't...
I think I saw him in September, even. But I saw him the other day, and I'm going over to see him this evening, I think.
You are?
We're supposed to get together tonight.
You haven't had things out with him.
Well, we're... I'm not sure I know what you mean by that.
I mean, got into things he's interested in.
Oh, I don't know. I guess I probably haven't. He hasn't, is he still doing his writing that he was doing?
No, he's doing,
he's
I think
doing
he's
his residency
radi-
now.
Well, no, he's in radiology.
Is he in radiology?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. He told me.
Yeah.
Was he practicing now?
Yes, he's,
He's a qualified doctor.
Oh, well, he's been an MD for some time.
Well, I mean, he's not just interning.
No, he did his interning up there, I think, somewhere. But he's doing what they call a residency now, where he's on the staff of the medical center for a while, and then after a while he's a radiologist. I don't know exactly what it is, but first you intern and then you're an MD, and then you have to do something after that if you want to specialize. He's done that too, actually. And then you do this thing called a residency.
Yeah.
And I think it's usually 2 or 3 years.
Don't tell me.
Maybe it's less. But you're actually a practicing physician when you're doing this.
Yeah.
And getting fees?
I think you do get something for it. It's not like an internship. I mean, it's not desperately poor or anything like that. I haven't really asked him the details about it yet, because I didn't have much time to talk to him the other night. There were other people there, but I think that this is the last thing that you do before you set yourself up.
I don't care about
that. He put it off because
I have no idea what
it.
Has been going through his mind.
Me either, actually. But I guess he has now come to some kind of decision because he went ahead and decided to do the residency. He had a period when he travels there. He was in England. And then he had this period when he stayed home and wrote the novel. That lasted a year, didn't it?
Uh-huh.
At least a year. And then last spring, he told me that this fall he had decided he was going to start, he was going to do his residency. He was going to start out here at the medical center, I think, in September, and he was going to move into an apartment. And that was that, so.
Well, that's just the mechanics of the thing.
Yeah.
So you still don't know what he's been up to, what is in his mind.
I sort of think, though he's never said it, that he's decided that he does want to do medicine as a full-time thing. That he spent his year writing novels and didn't really
feel
that he wanted to do this
for
the rest of
his
life.
What his thought has been, even to make a statement, Faye.
Well, he became, all I know is that he became very disillusioned with medicine.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
And
well,
we
yeah.
all know that.
Yes, but disillusioned on what account? I mean, you see, you still haven't said anything.
That's right.
I always suspected that it was because he couldn't get really a successful research position, though he never said that. But it occurred to me that Linton obviously didn't have the personality to be a bedside physician, and I always thought maybe he wanted to do research. And, of course, at Harvard Medical School, his chances. I mean, he shouldn't have gone there, I would think, if that's what he wanted to do. And radiology, in a sense, is somewhat along those lines, you know.
Leslie, find out tonight what he's been up to. Now, I don't care about his schedule. And write us a little postcard.
Well, it might not be so easy. It may take several trips. But he did mention to me once, just in passing, about how exceedingly difficult it was to get research positions, that you had to be, you know, in the top five in the class and that kind of thing. No, he couldn't have been that, because they made him take the last year over again, didn't they, before his internship. He had to do the fourth year over again, I think. So I think that maybe that had something to do with it. And I think also that he was disillusioned by the purely commercial aspect of medicine a lot.
This is what, it was my notion.
The year when he went around to the different hospitals and then later when he did his internship, the purely greed aspects of it that you don't think about so much if you're not closely connected with
most
the deal.
Of those big shots, you got to say, sir.
You don't not only have to say, sir, you have to pay in advance. I mean, really, it's the medical profession has gotten awfully far off, it seems to me, recently.
Yeah.
Yes.
You see, I can't leave home. Like I say, I know one or two sort of have with doctors here who will give me a shelf of pills if I need them. If I went out of town, you see, I wouldn't have a mechanic or a doctor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I try to go to doctors and dentists around here because, you know, out there, you're just in the wilds. You just have to pick up the phone book, and you don't know whom to go to. I told you about in Cornell when I tried to find out who to go to, and they told me the name of a doctor. And Dr. Buckley, I remember, and I called and tried to get an appointment in October. I needed a physical for an insurance policy. And the soonest that he could see me was in January. So I went to somebody else, and I read in the paper about the first week of December, he died. Dr. Buckley had a heart attack and passed on. My appointment, you see, if I had made it, would never have come up. I waited all the time.
Isn't that
something? But, you know, if you don't know who to go to, it really is possible to get a quack, almost.
Yeah. Eric, how do you keep up with your friends over in Athens, way out there?
Well, I think it doesn't take any longer for a air letter to go from out there than it does from the East Coast. They go over the polar route.
You hear from them?
Yes, I do. I hear from them that Christmas and Easter, in Greece, Easter is a bigger holiday than Christmas, and I usually get a whole set of Easter cards from them, you know. It always surprises me every year.
Oh.
But they usually send out cards at Easter, whereas we would at Christmas.
That's good.
And I try to see them in the summer.
You know more people in Greece than you know here.
Oh, I don't know about that. than I know in Gainesville. I suppose that's true.
You know people in Greece who are not in your profession.
Oh, yes, yes. Some of my Greek friends are just, you know, they don't even have secondary school education. Their parents and relatives of Greek friends that I've had over here, and one couple in particular just really adopted me and another friend of mine almost as children and with their own family, and we spent an awful lot of time with them. I've been going to see them every summer since then.
Nobody's adopted you here?
No, they haven't.
In Cornell?
No.
Or out there?
Somebody might out there, but I doubt it.
Huh?
I don't really think anyone will. These people's son is a fugitive from the Greek draft, and he can't come back to Greece. And I think that's one of the reasons why they have always taken such a liking to us.
Yeah.
We're about their son's age.
Yeah.
And it helps make up in part for the fact that he can't come back home.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant linguist. He finished up at Johns Hopkins, and then he just decided he didn't want to go back to Greece and waste 3 years of his life serving in the army, so he just took a job over here.
Yeah.
And that automatically meant that he became a fugitive from the Greek draft, and he would be arrested immediately if he returned to Greece.
Yeah. Now that's curious, isn't it? How is it that so many of the public people speak English still? Is that because they learned it under the empire?
In Greece, you mean? Or
Greece and India and Egypt and all those places.
I think that people just realize in those countries, with the possible exception of France, that you've got to know a foreign language in order to get ahead.
Yeah.
If you want to get a job, it's just like a high school diploma in a way.
Yeah.
At some point in your life in this country, you realize you have to have a high school diploma. You just can't
yeah.
make it. You're going to be the lowest sort of laborer if you don't finish high school.
So you've got to know French or English.
Right, because if you don't, you can't get a job in a gas station. Because there's so many tourists that have cars, you won't be able to give them gas. You can't get a job in a store, or one of the better stores, clerking. Because you have to know at least a little English or French. That's the first thing they're going to ask you. Just as it's here, you know, did you finish high school is the first thing they're going to ask you. And the
yeah.
second thing is going to be now, did you finish college? But over there it's going to be, did
you're
you finish?
You're not over there, Fee.
Well, I will.
Do you know English, or do you know French, or do you know German? That's just going to be the first question, and English particularly. And it's not just for us. That's the thing, you know, we keep thinking, well, they're all learning English because we're going over there, or
yeah.
because the English are going, and the English, of course, are
yeah.
even worse than we are at foreign languages. But it's not that at all. So they can converse with each other. And it's so funny to see Italians trying to talk to Greeks, or French trying to talk to Italians in English.
Yeah.
Their English is utterly wretched, of course. And their own languages are so similar, you would think that they would just be able to talk to
each other.
But it's...
Faye?
Yes?
Do you need the stove? You need the stove?
Yeah. But I've got...
Let me clear it for you. Huh?
I just took it off of the thing.
But do you need the stove?
Yes.
Okay. Let me clear it for you.
Just come on
before
we
get
about what you're doing. Yeah, I'm just
going to
fix a little bite for
yeah.
Why don't you let me take you out to supper? Then you won't have to fix anything. We could just go up to Ruby's or something like that.
I wouldn't be happy to do it if you take out and fix for you. It won't take me 10 minutes.
But I don't want you to fix anything after the trip.
Oh,
that's
you need
the
top up here?
Yeah, no. No, I'm just
going to
put some... It's
going to
be a real
bad
cookie.
Yes, there you are. It's all yours.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, yes,
sir. Now, here it goes.
Lessen the power of Congress to urge on the President to do certain things that I take it from your record, sir, you want him to do, get out of Vietnam. Have you voted?
I don't know what that is.
I don't want to see it. It just take me long enough. Nothing ever happens on Sunday, so the news programs are automatically suspect. We're going to be interviews or some awful thing like that. I think maybe I better call Linton up and...
Come on, call him, right here.
About what time? I didn't have time to call him before.
That's right.
I think I'm going
to... noisy, you see, so you see how...
Well, now, you take that. You take
that. I got a people out here. I'm about to drink water all day.
You take Laura, right?